Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Danielle, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Are Canadians poorer than we think?
Yes, that's the old BNS meme, right? That you're richer than you think marketing tagline we have, which is always the idea that you should borrow and spend more because you can have the capacity to spend if you use our credit facilities, right? So that theme has been so wide and prevalent, and that's how we've got into the worst consumer debt levels in Canada per household that we've seen in many decades. And so, of course, now that rates have leapt, people are defaulting, falling behind on payments. The portion of disposable income going to debt payments is the highest since we've seen in 2007. And that is making people realize that they're actually poorer than they think. It's interesting, TD came out with a chart today which shows per capita spending, real consumer spending per capita from the peak to the trough, and it's already today, from the second quarter of 2022 to the second quarter of 2025, in that range, it's on pace for a 3.3% decline, which is worse than the 2008-09 recession, which was a 2.5% decline in per capita spending in real terms. And it's approaching the early 1990s recession, which was, if you recall, Jim, also accompanied a real estate downturn in Canada. So those tend to be the worst and deepest recessions when you get a real estate downturn at the same time. And that was a 5% drop in real consumer spending per capita at that point. So we're already past 08-09 levels, and we're reaching towards the 1990s recession in terms of the impact to the downside. So it's rough because unemployment is rising. It's already come up from the all-time low, you know, nearly a full percent, and the Bank of Canada expects it to continue to rise over the next year or two. And, you know, a lot of people are barely making ends meet while they're fully employed or taking on second jobs. So if you start to see less employment available, of course, that's not going to help matters. So, yeah, it's rough. It's not something that gives me any pleasure to see, but it is something that was predictable just based on all the behaviors of the past few years and the low-rate era that lasted so long and encouraged so many people to become apathetic with their excess spending and debt. And I just thought that another really almost weird thing is that the Financial Post released did an article this week on the secret RCMP report. They linked to the report. You can read it. Some of it's redacted, but basically, the RCMP is warning the federal government that the income inequality in the country is becoming so extreme, and people are becoming more aware that they actually didn't get further ahead with all the handouts of the past few years. You know, they got these spending habits based on free money that are not possible now in this environment, and they're realizing that they're quite broke. And the RCMP just warns that civil unrest gets worse as people realize that they're not keeping up with the Joneses in any way, or that their future prospects are pretty grim, and especially for young people. So it just we're seeing a lot of that unrest in other countries and certainly in China, as the stock market there, you know, collapsed to levels seen since not seen since 2005. At the start of the year, and the real estate market there has been declining for, I think we're in the third year now of drops in the real estate market, and you're seeing a lot more public unrest and unemployment in the young people in China. So I think that's likely in our cards too, as the economic climate gets a bit worse. During the next part of this is the cutting part of the cycle where central banks start to ease financial conditions. And although it's quite common for the stock market and people to think, oh, great, that'll be the all-clear signal, you know, if they start cutting rates, everything will be well. The reality is that it doesn't turn on a dime. They're usually cutting rates because the economic climate is getting worse. They react to it by cutting interest rates. And the unemployment continues to rise as they do. And traditionally, especially if they've, you know, started cutting rates during an inverted yield curve, which is this cautionary warning sign for the entire economy, when they start cutting rates after they've been in this inverted yield curve phase, it typically is a worse economic downturn. And that's when stocks finally realize that they've been priced for a fantasy world of this soft landing, which is no more.
Now, going to this RCMP report, so what, they're going to have extra riot troops on hand or riot police, more jail cells? Is that going to be the government solution? And is there anything the government could do right now to make sure this doesn't happen, or is it already a fait accompli?
Well, yeah, I mean, the business cycle is a fait accompli. This one's been magnified because of the period of handouts and cheap money that went on for so long and the speculation that drove the cost of living so high, especially in things like housing. And so that we've been talking about that for quite a while, how, you know, the more than half of Canadians are spending most of their paychecks on trying to keep a shelter over their heads, whether that's rent or, you know, trying to buy. That math's been awful for quite a while. But as I say, once the unemployment piece ticks up, like employment deteriorates, you get more and more people in desperate straits. And, you know, we're seeing this correlation with, the 40% jump in car thefts, I believe it is, in Ontario just in the past year. It's incredible. And home invasions where people are looking for keys, and there's just a lot of stuff going on. So law enforcement is, you know, basically warning the government that these are trends that are going to need, you know, a response of some kind, whether it's increased funding for policing, whether it's increased funding for social programs. And, you know, the problem is that the government's been spending like we were in a recession all through this so-called recovery, like they bought the recovery through the highest government spending, wartime-style government spending, and they've got the deficits and debt to prove it, and now we're, you know, getting to that point where they're going to have to step up the support, or traditionally have, to support the economy. But again, there's been this crowding out effect because the government has been responsible for, you know, government spending, federal government spending is 35% higher now than it was pre-COVID, and that's, as I say, during the so-called recovery part of the economic cycle. So now it crowds out private sector investment. And so you're getting this lower business investment now in Canada than we saw in 2012. So all of these reference points are just a reflection of the fact that Canadian productivity has been horrible. And that means that we're suffering in terms of our cost of living, our standard of living. And it's becoming more and more apparent everywhere you look.
Now, Canadian productivity down. Is it the individual worker who's responsible? Why would that be? Are people working less and expecting more, or is it just an inefficient system?
Well, yeah, so it's the output. Our output has been poor, not as robust as it should be, because we have put a lot of capital towards non-productive activities like inflaming asset bubbles and housing prices, which is not an efficiency builder, it's an efficiency detractor. Again, the cost of shelter you need shelter, but the more it takes of the public purse or of the government backing of the private sector of households, the more that is required to just have that shelter, the less you have for everything else, right? And it doesn't actually increase income in the economy or improve standard of living beyond the shelter point. So that's part of it. We've malallocated too many resources to non-productive activities, to indeed counterproductive activities. Then the other thing was, of course, we had this, deficit of labor during the pandemic when people, and especially some of the service jobs, were afraid to go back to work. And so by the time employers were able to get enough workers, there was this holding period where they were afraid to let anyone go. And for a long time, they were trying to, keep that employment fully allocated, even as sales began to decline. And that's been happening across a broad swath of many sectors. You know, Jim, in Canada, the TSX, for example, the Canadian stock market, is just now back to where it was at the peak 2 years ago. But many of the sectors, most of the sectors, indeed all of the sectors except the oil and gas sector, which has risen again of late because of the jump in oil and gas prices again back around the $80 mark, but all of the other sectors have actually been flat or negative in terms of the equity price gains over the last 2 years. And this again is a reflection of the fact that corporate profits have been under pressure in most of those sectors. So what you get to now is a need to cut costs, right, to cut overhead. And this is where the layoffs have been ticking up, or giving people less hours per week to work. But so long as that output is still weak and employment is still relatively high, you've got a poor productivity setup. And that means, not enough output per worker. So that's what we're seeing now.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, are Canadians getting the service they deserve at banks, especially with the sky-high fees they charge that are among the highest in the world?
Well, what they get at banks is a sales pitch. That's what they always get, right? They're in the business of selling financial products, debt and stock market allocations, funds, equities, that sort of thing. Banks work for the corporations. Their clients are the corporations they help to fund. They help them to either in the person of loans, which they extend, or in helping them raise capital from other investors, right? So packaging securities and selling them to the public, that's where the meat of certainly on the investment banking side, that's where the meat of the revenue comes from. And the individuals are just the distribution channel. They're seen as, how do we get this product into their accounts and get them to give us their cash for it? And that's the business model. So it's not surprising that banks are always, trying to sell people products. And that means at the expense of their financial strength, because if you're, a lot of people are just financially inept. They just don't know. They haven't been taught any good principles. They get a lot of misguided or misleading ideas about what they should be doing with their financial resources. And so they go to places like banks for input or advice. And of course, what they get there is people working at the banks are given increasingly aggressive quotas to, get so many lines of credit or credit cards or TFSAs opened or this type of account so they can put products in it. And so Marketplace does a expose every once in a while. They hadn't done one for a little bit. They did one recently, which I posted on the blog, and just found that there was this, terribly trained people with half-baked, advice, information, telling people erroneous facts and trying to get them to, not pay off their credit and instead, keep the credit product out and put any money they have into the quote-unquote investment side so that the bank wins on both fronts, but the individual loses.
It seems that Vietnam doesn't take financial fraud very lightly. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for the mastermind of Vietnam's largest financial scam. Apparently, he made off with $20 billion, or about 5% of Vietnam's gross domestic product.
Wow. Yeah. They a lot of communist countries, like in China, they have had a very heavy crackdown as well on anybody that was, you know, involved in anything financially sketchy in the last few years. And there was a lot, because when money's flowing, there's a lot of scams. It's pretty typical. So yeah, they are pretty brutal on arresting people and death penalty and all sorts of things for that type of stuff. But I'm afraid in the free world, we aren't seeing that kind of crackdown. You know, we continue to see people mostly pay cost of business, doing fines, and walk away. It tends to be, you know, little independent people maybe get busted and thrown in jail the odd time, but people that work at the large institutions are constantly being caught up and shown to be, you know, doing these sketchy things, and they just pay fines and walk away. So that's why we have rampant financial fraud in this part of the world. That's why, you know, I think there's a breakdown of trust in the institutions, and I think it's getting worse. And of course, the government has been involved in that as well, because they're mostly, you know, to a large degree captured by their corporate sponsors. Certainly in the U.S., it's outrageous. You see, you know, government officials front-running their insider information, buying stocks and options, and having this incredible trading acumen, which is, of course, based on insider information that the public doesn't get. And so, you know, what can you do? You've got a whole generation of people who think that the rule of law doesn't apply to certain sects of the population, and that includes, you know, insiders, finance types, politicians. And until we break that, I think that, you know, there's not a lot of disincentive for many of these behaviors. So that's a problem.
BC NDP Premier David Eby refuses to do the number one recommendation of the BC money laundering inquiry, and that was to hire a money laundering czar to crack down on these fraudsters. What kind of message does that send to the public?
Yeah, well, there you go, case in point. And this is the problem when you're in bed with your, like, the you know, the institution or the companies you're supposed to be regulating and cracking down on are actually providing a good deal of your revenue stream, and this is what's happened with governments. You know, I mentioned that 30 years ago, I remember when casinos were illegal in Canada, and you had to go to places like, you know, Vegas or
or a cruise ship.
Atlantic City.
Or a cruise ship. Yeah.
So you had to do any of those trips to gamble, and then the slippery slope began of allowing some online trading, and then all of a sudden online gambling, I mean, and then, you know, we got to full on the situation we are today, and it's not good. I'm hoping the pendulum swings back, as it has throughout history a few times. The public, you know, attraction or interest for gambling hopefully will subside again in the future, and then we can crack down on some of this again, because we pay heavily. We pay in the money laundering through the fentanyl drug trade, through the, you know, housing bubble, through all kinds of financial fraud, and our country ends up worse off, more inefficient, you know, higher cost of living. And that's what's breaking apart some of the social fabric that I was speaking of at the beginning.
Well, and a new study just found out of the top wealthiest nations on the world, Canada has the fewest doctors per capita. Only 82% of Canadians have a family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have a couple of friends that have family practices that are, you know, coming up to 60, and they are saying there's no point in, you know, they would like to retire, but there's no value. No one wants to buy your practice. You know, there's no one interested in paying money even for something turnkey, because there's such a deficit of service providers that someone can come out of school and start from scratch and, you know, have a lot of patients. So it is a problem, because as you know, we've had this big growth in our population. And again, the way incentives are, we have to look at where we're, you know, what things we're subsidizing. You should subsidize the things you want more of and tax the things you want less of. You know, surely we want less pollution and environmental destruction and more health and health support and social support for the things that will make us better, brighter, more educated, all that kind of stuff.
In Europe, if you have the marks, you go to university for free. In Canada, you pay through the nose.
Yeah, well, I mean,
if we want more doctors and nurses, why can't they go to school tuition free to encourage people to do it?
Well, there would be, you know, there's a bunch of ideas around that stuff. But I think it's true. I think Canada's still relatively better off in many ways in our university system than in some other countries. It's still, you know, not as insanely priced as some places like in America. But yeah, we have a general interest in making sure people get access, not just to university, but trades and all sorts of training programs to provide the workers that we need for the society, and especially in an aging demographic. That's all very important.
Danielle, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, it's just that, you know, we're into the central banks talking about, okay, we're going to start cutting interest rates sometime this year. We saw that the Swiss National Bank actually did cut overnight their first, and other banks, certainly the Bank of Canada, is talking about it. We're going to hear from them next in April to see whether they, you know, it's about 50-50 whether they ease 25 basis points in April at this point, but if not, perhaps in June. And although that is going to be some help for people with floating rate debt, a 25 basis point decrease, I think if they start to see the unemployment rate really pick up, which I expect that it will, you're going to have them potentially cut faster than just, three 25 beep cuts this year. But I would just caution people, again, we saw a long lag in terms of the hiking that they did. You know, it took about 18 months to 2 years to really filter through after they began the hiking. And it also takes about a year or more for the cutting to really have an easing impact. So we have a tricky bit here. And like I said, it's not the norm that asset markets rally once the cutting begins. They often do in reflex or in euphoria of the idea of rate cuts starting, but it's more once they get into it, they're reacting to bad economic data and rising unemployment and profit compression and disappointing sales and all that. And so that's when things like the stock market typically do the worst of their bear market losses. So I just warn people that, you know, as much as the Canadian market has gone nowhere for a couple of years, it's rebounded again. You know, since last fall, it's another opportunity to reduce your exposure, or take some profits, or try and be defensive for what comes next.
And I do feel sorry for them. Gucci expects their profits will be down 20% in this quarter, even though rich aren't buying anymore.
We're seeing that across the board. Well, it wasn't just rich people that were buying those real designer products. It was a lot of regular people who were using government funds or handouts to actually buy those products. So you're starting to see a lot of them listed on resale sites, which is something the luxury brands don't like. But again, this people need cash, so they're looking to sell things that they have. And so that ultimately will hurt these luxury brands as well if there's a whole bunch of supply on the secondary market.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.